How much of our vocabulary is actually French?
Why do we call it a pig in the pen, but pork on the plate?
And how can we think of French as being all fancy?
We will go tête-à-tête as we discuss the liaisons between French and English, but don't worry, we won't get too risqué in this episode of Words Unraveled.
Bienvenue dans cet épisode de Mots Décortiqués. Je suis Rob Watts de Rob Words sur YouTube.
That is, welcome to another Words Unraveled. I am Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell. And that lovely French introduction by Rob was a translation for typical introduction, wasn't it?
Yeah, sort of. We really struggled to work out what the French for unraveled was. They don't have like a perfect translation of it. Another good idea would have been to use dénouer, which means to untie, which is where we get the word dénouement. But we went with décortiquer on the advice of my wife, because
yes,
I have a French wife. I should mention that.
Our expert consultant, your spouse. Yeah.
Indeed. And the reason why I've got this delightful cock on my jumper, that was a gift from her sisters.
It's lovely. That's very exciting. So how fluent would you say you are in French? Completely?
The word fluent is such a big word,
right?
Isn't it? I can navigate any situation in French. I might sound a bit like a caveman occasionally, and I might have to, you know, scrabble around for a similar word. But yeah, I manage. You know, I did my wedding speech in French. I got away with it. Yeah, so I'm okay. Certainly enough to be able to spot the many French words that are in English. And that's what this episode is all about. The enormous influence that the French language has had on the English language.
And I am not a French speaker, but I studied it, you know, more than 18 years ago in school and spent time speaking it to some degree in Morocco for a little while. So I can read The Hobbit in French comfortably, but I don't have anybody to practice with conversationally and listening comprehension wise. I'm terrible.
Well, by the end of this, maybe once you've spotted a few more extra French words in the English language, you'll suddenly be slightly less sort of daunted by the prospect.
There are quite a few French words in English for good reason.
Yeah, and they say around 29-30% of the words in the English language are French. That doesn't mean that, you know, 29 or 30% of the words you actually use are French. Of the sort of top 100 words that we use day to day, only I think one or two of those are French. So the words people and number. The nuts and bolts of our language is Germanic, because it is a Germanic language, but for historic reasons, it is clad in a sort of very elegant French dress, almost absolutely rammed full of French words.
In particular, a lot of our Latin-derived words, which make up like up to 50 to 60% of the English vocabulary, not grammar, traveled through French on their way to English.
Yeah, that's the bizarre thing about English. The majority of words, the majority of the lexicon is not Germanic, but the majority of the words coming out of our mouths are. For example, I think I just used the word majority that I just used, that's from French. But in that sentence, I don't think any of the other ones were, for example.
Right. So yes, one thing that skews the data is that many of these words are ultimately Latin derived. So like one variation or part of speech will have come to English via French, while another one was adopted via Latin or just back formed, which we can get into some back formations that went French and then got turned into English verbs and things like that later.
Yeah. And there are also plenty of occasions where we've borrowed the same French word twice, but from different dialects of French or from different eras. So let's start with, you know, when French really starts to get, you know, its feet under the table of the English language in a very, the date, the year that every English person knows, and maybe every American as well, 1066.
That's right. When William the Conqueror, aka William the Bastard, set up shop as the ruling class, infusing the Germanic Old English language and transforming it into Middle English.
There's this arbitrary line that's drawn after the Battle of Hastings, where William the Conqueror conquers, you know, and he's the Duke of Normandy, but he becomes, you know, the King of England. And after that, we say that's Middle English, and everything before that is Old English. And the main reason that we draw that distinction is the amount of French between the languages. But it obviously it has to be a, you know, it can't have just been one day. Everyone started speaking a different version of English. It didn't happen like that.
Everywhere from like 1150 to like 1500 is really like the smear of time that we're looking at.
And the really key things that William of Normandy does when he becomes King of England, and that influence particularly the types of French words that we end up getting, are he gets rid of all the nobles, right? All the Anglo-Saxon nobility, nobility being a French word actually as well. And he replaces them with his mates. So before, you know, the Anglo-Saxons have things like earls and athelings. Afterwards, we end up with, you know, barons and dukes, counts, marquises. So all of these titles change. So you've got this power dynamic already starting to shape up with the French, the Normans ruling the roost. But not only that, he sacks all of the bishops as well. All but one, actually. There's one holdout Anglo-Saxon bishop that for some reason he doesn't sack. But the rest of them he does. So
wait,
French...
who, hang on, you can't just...
his name's Wulfstan. And yeah, I don't know. He just...
Okay,
obviously,
dude.
Very good networker, but he manages to stay in post, but the rest of them don't. So you've got Norman domination of religion as well, and then the courts as well, and chivalry, wartime. All of these are areas where we suddenly get a load of French words coming in, and they're the domains of the ruling classes.
That's why sometimes Latin-derived words that traveled through French or Latin-derived words in general have been perceived as, say, like fancier or more sophisticated than Germanic-derived English words.
And that's something that never changes, really. French is always seen as fancy, and it continues to be seen as fancy today. But as a result of the Normans taking control of the courts, for example, we get the word court, we get the word judge, jury, attorney, a prison. These all enter the English language, replacing or sitting alongside Anglo-Saxon alternatives. In culture, we get words like music and painting and theater.
Yeah, they're also controlling higher education of the time. So we've got all our abstract concepts, our arts and literature, our fashion and luxury, our war and politics to some degree too, philosophy and science, government and society, aesthetics.
Yeah, and the Anglo-Saxons really are sort of just reduced to this kind of peasant class. I don't think it's too much to say that either. It's something that gets brought up in this discussion because it's endlessly fascinating. The signs of the power dynamics between the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons that persist to this day in our language.
And they're in the most fundamental parts of language, like cuisine versus food, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And specific foods as well. I mean, there's that, the one that people like to talk about is the fact that, you know, a cow has a Germanic name when it's in the field, but when it's on our plate, it's boeuf, it's beef, it's got a French name. What are the other ones of that? You've got sheep and mutton.
Pig and chicken become pork and poultry when they're on the table.
Yeah, venison and deer. Mm. As well. Actually, there's a really good quote from Ivanhoe, which is written by Walter Scott, the Scottish novelist, in 1819. But it's about an Anglo-Saxon family that's surrounded by Normans, and their jester called Wamba says, "There is old Alderman Ox continues to hold his Saxon epithet while he's under the charge of serfs and bondsmen such as thou, but becomes beef, a fiery French gallant when he arrives before the worshipful jaws that are destined to consume him."
Delightful.
Yeah. It's one of those, the comparison of the meat and the animal is something that always does very well on social media.
Right.
But Walter Scott was doing it a good couple of centuries before us, and yeah, it was going down very well then as well.
The other major one you hear, or at least I come across the most frequently, is the difference between house and mansion, which mansion is just an alteration of the French word that is now maison. So both mean house.
Yeah.
But one of them is the fancy house where the French people live.
And, you know, we can have a meal, or we can have a banquet, which is a French word, or a feast, which is a French word. You know, we can have dinner or supper, or like, because they're having extra meals, these wealthy French people. Here's a really interesting one that I don't think gets talked about that much. And that is that our names for family members are very interesting, because our close family, our father, mother, daughter, brother, sister, son, they're all Germanic words. But as soon as we start to look beyond the immediate household, so grandfather is a sort of hybrid of French grand and the Germanic father, but other ones like niece, nephew, aunt, uncle, these are all French, cousin. Why does that reflect the power dynamic? Well, you only really need to know about distant relatives if you're interested in genealogy and dynastics, basically. I mean, if you're just handing down the family farmstead to, you know, the son, then you don't really need to know about your cousins and such, and you don't necessarily need to have words for them. So that's why all these words for extended family have come from French. It's really juicy, this stuff. And it's amazing how long it sticks around. You know, this is, we're talking about dynamics from the best part of 1,000 years ago. And we need to mention that it stays this way with French as the language of the ruling class in England for 300 years. Because you not only have the Normans, but they're followed by another French dynasty. They're not from Normandy. You have the Angevin dynasty or the Plantagenets, right? Who, speaking an ever so slightly different version of French, they're not speaking Norman French, which has its own characteristics, which I've talked about before, being a bit sort of Germanic. The Normans were essentially Norse men who'd settled in northern France. But then you've got the Plantagenets, who are speaking a central dialect, which is a bit closer to what we think of as French now. It's a bit closer. For example, the W sounds in Norman French are not in the Angevin French, in the one that the Plantagenets are speaking. They become these G sounds that we're used to. So we have warden from Norman French and guardian from the later Angevin French, and wage and gauge and warranty and guarantee. I'm always going on about this, aren't I, Jess? But I just think it's really interesting.
No, I like it though. Should we address why French is so Latin?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. Yeah, why is it, Jess?
Before Rome went on its conquering spree, modern day France was populated primarily by Celtic people and some Germanic people, most notably the Gauls, who spoke Gaulish, which was a Celtic language. A few words from the Gauls still persist in modern French. One of them is alouette, the word for lark. Another one, which we use sort of in English, is mouton, for sheep, which is now mutton, right?
Yeah.
And then a couple others like bruyère for heather and chemin for path or road. But so few generally because the Romans did a really good job of suppressing that language once they took power. They were really good at that.
It's something they didn't manage in Britain, the big strongholds of the Romans in Western Europe, you know, Spain, France, Portugal, Romania, Italy, end up with their own Romance languages, right? The languages of those places are all descendants of Latin. You know, I think they call them Vulgar Latins. I can't remember whether you're not supposed to say Vulgar Latin or what. It doesn't have in Britain because the Romans are in Britain as well, you know, before the Anglo-Saxons. They hop it in the, is it the 5th or the 4th century? I think it's the 5th century. They sort of leave Britain to rack and ruin, and it enters, you know, the so-called Dark Ages. But it hasn't fully displaced. I mean, there's no trace of whatever Roman British Latin was. I mean, there must have been one. They must have had a way of speaking.
Tiny little words here and there.
Yeah. We don't know. I think that's really, really interesting that there isn't a British Roman Latin, but French, yeah, basically all the French dialects are. What we call French today is really a dialect of Paris that's spread around. This is a thing that happens a lot. It's like modern German is just one dialect of German, a high German that we now call German, and Spanish is Castilian Spanish, and it's the Spanish of the royal family in Spain, but we now call it just Spanish.
You know, in France, we also have some post-Roman smudging of Germanic languages too, right? Around the 5th century, we start crumbling and Germanic tribes are coming in, and we've got the Franks who settled in northern Gaul, and then we've got some Normans coming in from Viking land, you know?
And this is the explanation for these differences I was talking about the W and the G thing. You also have differences in K and Ch, which are responsible for a lot of double borrowings that we've done. It's why we've got castle, right, and chateau. So castle is coming from one French dialect and chateau is coming from another one, where you've got the K and the Sh. And the same happens with the words cattle and chattel as well. I think it's reasonable to think of French as a monolith, but it really isn't. Because even now we're only talking about a certain type of French language, which they call the langue d'oui which means the languages of yes, but like we. But then in southern France, you've got the Languedoc, where oc is just their word for yes. And you've got langue de si, and there are all these different languages around French. And I imagine there's some irritation in parts that what is known as French is really just one of these dialects.
So we talked about French words that entered English in early Middle English, and then started moving into late Middle English, where we get our more abstract, like academic topics. And then, of course, more words have come in from French in the more modern era, from like 1700s to the present. Those to the ear sound a little bit more French because they've retained their spelling and such, like boutique and hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The French words have been in English for... So occasionally my wife and I will have an argument about how an English word should be pronounced, because she wants it to better reflect the French word that it came from. You say, but it came over 900 years ago. 900, already, we've had plenty of time to make it our own. Thank you very much.
It's already been smashed into English shape.
Yes. And also, the way that French is spoken today does not directly reflect how it was spoken 1,000 years ago. It doesn't reflect old French pronunciation.
Old French is more influential on English, right? In a way.
That's absolutely true. You know, you see this in words like state and stage, a lot of stuh words, scout in English, right? That have this S in there, which is a relic of the old French words, which would have been estat or estate. Oh, actually, yeah, estate.
Consonants didn't get turned into diacriticals, you know?
Yeah, so you have all of these old French words that begin with E-S-T or E-S-C. And what happens over the centuries afterwards is French that's around now loses the S sound and English loses the E at the start. And so that's how you see, but once you know that, it actually makes it easier to find French words in the English language, particularly, or to spot French words and translate them. I think étage, meaning stage, is when you see an E with this accent on it, it's actually really reasonable to put an S afterwards and see if it sounds like an English word. And it'll sometimes sound... find that it does, which is really interesting. Or if you see a circumflex, so that's a little hat on some of the vowels, that's a French spelling reform. When they removed a load of S's, they put a little hat on the vowel next to it to tell you that an S has been removed. And that's why you have hostel, which we get from French at one point, then hotel, right, which is spelt in French, hotel with a hat on the O, because at one point it was hostel. Hôpital is the same. Hospital. You know, there's these little clues that can actually really help you to translate French words.
And this is just how like phonotactics across both languages is shaken out. It's like how comfortable it is to say two letters together one way or another. This also happens in English too. Like whenever we see like GH in daughter, slaughter, or if you turn it into an F, laughter, you're looking at a word that in earlier versions of English was usually like a CH sound, like dochter or slochter. That was just very uncomfy for the Normans, you know?
Right. Yeah. So they're changing the words to suit, like you say, phonotactics, their own ways of just saying things and what they're capable of saying. Yeah. Because they're also rubbish at H's as well.
Yeah, right. And there were different H sounds in Old English, right? You could double up H's and have them make different sounds.
Words like Lord, we've talked about, I'm sure before, how the word Lord, Clafod, begins with an H in Old English. All of these H's at the start of these HL words disappear when the Normans come over because they can't hack it, basically. They cannot hack it. So they disappear and we use all these HL words. And are there any HL words left in English? I'm not sure, but Old English is absolutely rammed full of them.
We also borrowed apostrophes from French, right?
Is that so? Tell me about it.
There is some debate about how this happened, but like possessive apostrophes, for instance, note the removal of an E in most situations, like the Nightes Sorde or the Nichtes Sorde in the past would have been spelled with an ES at the end. So the Knight's Sword was indistinguishable from the multiple Knight's Swords or the knights who were doing something else entirely. French had already started using apostrophes to denote words that had literally been turned away from the word, because that's what that word means, apostrophe right. means in Greek. Whenever we talk about this, people will also mention there are a couple of instances of like people mentioning like the man, his horse or something as a notation that like that the apostrophe has taken those letters out of the word. That's a bendy and not quite correct
it's not true.
Explanation. Yeah, it's just not
it's
quite
not,
right.
It's not true. There are citations where you find that construction, the man, his horse, but that's overcompensation.
And you can also see this happening in real life if you look at like a modern English translation of the Canterbury Tales versus the Middle English translation, or not translation, the Middle English in which it was originally written. Yeah. Like in the Canterbury Tales, ladies love Drury was ladies love Drury. And now you'll see an apostrophe on it, but before it was L-A-D-Y-E-S. And that indicated possession. So now we would have an apostrophe there indicating that the E there has been removed.
This leads us very neatly onto something else we should mention, which is that vocabulary is not the only way in which French influences English during this period. It's also, there are grammatical changes that are influenced by it. And one of them is the fact that, yes, we can say the knight's sword, but it's also possible in English now to say the sword of the knight.
Right.
And that is just a French construction of the same thing that, you know, the old English has this way of inflecting things to make it. So the knight's sword is the old English way of doing it, but the sword of the knight, l'épée du chevalier, is the sword of the cavalier, of the knight. By the way, chevalier, is this a good time to go into double borrowings a bit further?
Yeah, let's do it.
So cavalry, chivalry, and cavalier, they're all borrowings of the same French word just over and over again, which comes from, well, Jess, where does it come from?
Horse. They're horses.
Yeah. Cheval is the French for horse. One of the first words you learn in your French lessons at school. So they're all horsey men.
And we got our little chess piece still, right?
Yeah. There you go. I have got a list of these. Oh, here's a good one. Vanguard and avant-garde.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. Vanguard is just the phrase avant-garde that's gone through some English processing. We mentioned hotel and hostel as well. Chief and chef, right? These are just the same borrowing from French, just in completely different eras. The second one in an era where, people are really keen, particularly when talking about cuisine, to use the French word. But it's a French word for boss, right? It doesn't mean a cook at all. It just means the boss. It just happens to be the boss of the kitchen, the chef. Person and parson come from the same French
word. Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I didn't know that before I was looking these up earlier. Petty and petite, that's quite simple. These mean French words for small. Ticket and etiquette. Etiquette is not a ticket, it's a label. And the concept of etiquette comes about in the court of Louis XIV, you know, the Sun King. It's this idea of having rules that only those who are worthy of the court are aware of. Right. So it's exclusionary rules, and they call this system etiquette. I think it's something they actually borrowed from the Spanish royalty. So legal and loyal and regal and royal both come from the same two words. You know what I mean? And here's a good one. So far as I know, we've borrowed the word gentil. So the French word for nice. Or
genteel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So genteel is one of them.
Right.
Gentle is another. Gentile.
That's what I was going to ask.
Non-Jewish person. Yeah, it does come from the same place. But here's one that might surprise you. The fourth one is jaunty.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's from jaunty from the French, which I really like. I couldn't find another French word that we've borrowed four times, but, you know, we've got fete, feast, and festival, which all ultimately come from the same French source.
We also have so many words that include the word joy, like joy and jolly and enjoy and everything else that comes from that has just come in at different times independently from French.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So a joy and jolly, are they related, those words then?
Ultimately, both from French joie and jolie. And then, of course, we have like joie de vivre, right? Where we just borrowed the whole phrase wholesale.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we've got joie and joy. It's funny. And the ones, as Jess said earlier, the ones that sound and look really French are the the newer borrowings.
That would be like Deja Vu and Rendezvous and things like that.
Yes, exactly. And etiquette is one of the sort of newer ones as well. You get all of these words, again, as Jess mentioned earlier, in the 1700s, right, where there becomes a real sort of, it's a fashion. It's a mania for borrowing French words into English to sound really fancy.
Because it's so fashionable.
Yeah. And it is fashion. Yeah, that's what it's all down to. At the same time, you get coquette coming from French, which we like. Connoisseur, which we make a terrible mess of when we pronounce it in English. Ballet, coterie. Here's one. Do you use this term in America? Do you use the term cul-de-sac?
Oh, yeah, it's horrible.
I mean, it's an abomination of a pronunciation.
It's like the origin of it is awful.
Yeah.
It's a medical term.
It literally means bottom of the bag.
In French it does, but in English and in French, it was a word for a diverticulum, like a little bulging pouch in your intestine. And that was compared
to the little...
And someone was like, gee, that looks a whole lot like the little cove on my road.
Who gets to a dead end and decides that? Dead end is much better, by the way.
Germanic term
for it instead. Mm-hmm. And cul, at the start of cul-de-sac, that does literally mean your ass, right? I mean, it's a rude word for your ass as well as the bottom.
Oh my goodness. A couple others that are kind of fun and have maybe not unexpected origins. Papier-mâché or paper-mâché is fortunately not literal in most cases. It means chewed paper.
Oh, okay. Mâché is something is mâché is chewed.
An au pair, which we use as a name for a person now, a person you would hire to be a nanny, you might say, or a permanent live-in nanny, was originally just a word for the arrangement. And it just means like on equal footing or like paired. The idea here is the person lives and works in your house in exchange for room and board. And that is an equivalent exchange.
Yeah, the dynamics have changed a little bit, but that makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
We also use tête-à-tête now. That one's pretty self-explanatory. Head-to-head. Milieu, a person's social environment. I feel like no one uses that unless they're like trying to be particularly snooty.
Which just means the middle of something, the milieu. Yeah. Yeah.
A middle place. And it's like, it's your social environment. It's whatever you are immersed in, your milieu.
Yeah. Another, a similarly pretentious one is when people say mélange instead of mix.
Yes.
Which is just the French word for mix.
And they're all over menus, right? Like du jour.
Yeah. I can tell you a story about when, my hometown, Derby, we're not fancy people in Derby. So when I took it was for my nan's birthday, we went to a restaurant. It wasn't a good restaurant. And on the menu, under the desserts, it said strawberry gâteau with an X at the end of it. And when it arrived, my wife pointed out that there was only one gâteau and pointed it out to the waiter. I nearly died. they don't know how to construct a French plural here. Leave them to it.
That reminds me of another word we've borrowed, and it's liaison, right? We'll use it as like a liaison. Let's liaise. I kind of hate that one, but let's liaise over something. And in French, it's a union or a binding together. But it also is in French grammar, and it's the phenomenon that causes a silent consonant. That's why I bring up this in relation to gâteau, because a silent consonant at the end of one word will attach itself audibly to the next word, like in the term beaux-arts, which normally you wouldn't pronounce the X at the end of beau, but it's attached to the arts afterwards.
Yeah, the liaison, the reason why sometimes if you're trying to learn French, listening to it is just like, I don't know, listening to a cascade of soup, word soup. I mean, you can't, because all the words run into each other. And that is this sort of liaison. Actually, that's a good point to mention some of the French words that we've taken out. Because one of the big reasons why there are so many French words in English is that English is very good at, I'm personifying English here, but I don't know. I mean, the speakers of English.
We as the English language.
Yeah. are really good at adopting words, but giving them, to use another French word, a nuance, right? So that they can sit alongside our existing words rather than replace them. This would have been something that would have been happening with the Anglo-Saxons, right? They'd have been learning these new French words, but not wanting to get rid of their native Anglo-Saxon Old English words, which is why we have, you can ask something or you can demand it. But demander is just the French for ask. Yeah, it doesn't have that forcefulness to it. But in English, we've given it that so that we can have both words.
I feel like a debacle is more of a like sticky situation in English than a debacle, which is like a collapse or a disaster, right?
Yeah. And there are lots of really simple ones as well, just like answer and respond, right? Answer and respond are very, very similar words, but they're not identical. To wish and to desire, you know, they're slightly different. To begin and to commence. Here I'm trading off the Germanic word with the French word in each situation. To look and to regard. You know, very often the French word is somehow poncier, but not necessarily. It's just different.
Does the word risque carry the same connotation in French as it does in English?
It is both the past participle of to risk something. So
it's
something
risky,
risked.
Yeah.
But it also does carry the same.
Okay.
So I think I remember distinctly asking this very question.
It's also French and sexy.
Yeah. You go to the Moulin Rouge, you're going to see something a little bit risque there. Yeah, I think that's legit. Another thing that we've done that I also think is quite interesting, and again shows the sort of prestige idea of French, is so if we talk about the brain, right, we refer to things related to the brain as mental, or we talk about our house, that is all things domestic. And so we've applied French adjectives to Anglo-Saxon nouns, town and urban, stuff like that. And I guess that's because... Actually, why would that be? But it because, you know, when you're dealing with the administration of these things, it's somehow higher status. I don't know.
That's entirely possible.
It's interesting. And obviously with brain and mental, you're talking about, you know, medicine, where they're borrowing foreign words all the time to shield us from the truth of what they're talking about usually.
I also like the way we've adapted the word souvenir, right, as a noun. It's a verb in French, meaning like to remember, to come to mind. And now it's like a thing you buy. It's been fully capitalized.
We've done that quite a lot. We've played fast and loose. But I feel I should point out that the French are doing exactly the same to English these days.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like and to me, it's worse. Have you ever come across, there's this atrocious French verb that every time I hear it, I have to sort of really grit my teeth. Because I hear it quite a lot, because we like to go for a run, you know, go out for a jog. They have le jogging, which is obviously questionable because it's a noun. But they have a much worse word for jogging.
What's that?
Which is le footing.
Le footing.
I really hate it. But they do use it. They really like the ing words because it gives them a sort of English twang, right? So they have le parking for a car park, or le shopping they use. I mean, that's okay. We call it shopping as well, I suppose. But it's not the same.
There's one in particular that was especially egregious. L'aquaplaning.
Which is funny because the planing at the end of there is from a French word, right? The French word for glide, which is plane or plan, gives us the idea of an aquaplane, right? Which is funny. And again, we've got these sort of, are they called reborrowings? I can't remember. Is it reborrowing when you borrow something twice or when you borrow something that you've lent out? I can never remember. I think reborrowing is when a language lends to another language as much as you can lend a word and then takes it back. And French has done that quite a lot and continues to do it. A really, really good example of this is French has taken on the word tennis, right? For the sport, but also for a tennis shoe. It calls a trainer a tennis or a basket, short for basketball shoe. But tennis is the French word tourner, which means basically take it or hold it. It's what you would shout as you hit something at someone.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And so they've now taken that word back for the name of the sport that ultimately is named after their word for it, because tennis is a French sport.
What is the timeline on chauffeur? Because it literally means a stoker of a steam engine, because the first motor cars were steam driven.
That is such a revelation, Jess. Because chauffer in French means to warm something.
Yeah.
It's from chaud, right? Meaning warm. And I'd never made that link. So chauffeur is someone
who's a stoker. Yeah, right.
That's brilliant, Jess.
Isn't it?
Oh,
it's fun.
Right. If that was the only sentence in this entire podcast, it would be worth listening to. I love that.
Also, I don't know if you know this. Do you know what the connotation of the word panache is in French now? In English, it means elaborateness. Yeah. We got jazz panache. But it was a word for like a French word for a tuft or a plume of feathers that you would wear on your hat.
Oh, really?
So I don't know whether today panache has been reborrowed as, or not, maybe not reborrowed, but the sense of it has been adjusted in French, or if it still means feathers.
They do have a drink in France called a panache, which is, you know, panache with an E accent on the end of it. And it is what we in England call a shandy, what they hear in Germany call a Radler. I don't know if you have a name for it in America.
These are beers,
America,
right?
That it is beer mixed with lemonade.
Oh.
Do you have a name for that? I mean, to be fair, your beer over there is so weak you don't need to do it.
The shandies that I've had here have just been beer, but they've been like craft beers that have sort of a citrusy flavor. Somebody's going to correct me on that. I do drink a lot of craft beer, which is not very weak, thank you.
No, it's true. But it's the same all over
but
the world.
But that's because, I mean, I also don't drink Miller Lite. I go to the local brewery down the street and try whatever concoction they've made.
I've really diverted us here. So a panache is a shandy. Although in England, like ordering a shandy is kind of unacceptable. But here in Germany, ordering a Radler is A-okay. And actually, there are moments where it's really what you need. Because they obviously have lovely lagers here, you know, fizzy pilsners and hellers that actually mix very well with a bit of lemonade. But you don't want to mix a British bitter.
I feel like American English needs a variation on that that spins on the Arnold Palmer, which is iced tea and lemonade. The Arnold Schwarzenegger Palmer. Make it a little stronger.
We've ended up on booze, Jess.
Yeah, we have. Shall we go to sex instead?
Yes, please.
I just wanted to talk through a couple of like French words that have like meanings that you may not have considered completely, like boudoir, which we use. And we use like if you're getting a boudoir shoot or whatever, you're in your skivvies and getting, you know, sexy photos taken of you. But the French word that this comes from, boudet, means to pout or to sulk. Your boudoir was your room where you would, your grumpy room where you would go and sulk. And the idea was it was a lady's private room. The desserts known as ladyfingers are also called boudoirs in French, evidently because one might enjoy them in one's boudoir.
Okay, so if someone was to invite you to the boudoir, they'd be inviting you to kind of just their private little place, their little inner sanctum, their sanctuary.
Their sulky room.
There we go.
We've talked about sabotage, I think, a couple of times before, so I won't belabor it, but it means to like throw your wooden shoe in the machinery. It's related to our word like sabaton and other things like that. A lot of these words for like protest and war and conflict and revolution have come over from French in the same way. I also wanted to note that when you call a political action a coup, it is always short for coup d'etat. Before that phrase, it just meant any general blow or strike and was not associated with political action.
It's a word that gets used an awful lot in French. Day to day, coup is a hit or a strike or an instance of something.
It also appears in our French word coupon, which is something that you
does
cut.
It?
Yeah, right. It is a piece cut off, something you coupé from something else.
Oh, that's very good. Oh, but is that not to cut?
Coup originally is a blow or a strike or a cut. Or a punch or a slap. Like it had a lot of meanings throughout history.
I see. So that's a really multi-purpose term. Coup. Yeah, because you can have like a coup de poing, right? In French is a punch. Your poing is your fist. Coup de pied is a kick.
Lots of striking and clapping and cutting. And
it's a really useful word to have in your back pocket. Mm-hmm. Don't have posh.
I didn't realize until recently that debonair was all three words. Like it was three words separately, de bon air.
Oh, so what would that literally mean?
Of good appearance or of good lineage, of good airs.
Oh,
kind of like putting on airs, you know.
Yeah,
you might
it's
think.
Exactly that, isn't it? It's exactly that.
Also, pedigree is from pied de grue, which is an old French phrase meaning a foot of a crane. And in genealogical charts of the time, descent from one generation to another was indicated by a little forked symbol that looked like a crane's foot.
That's spectacular.
Right. Isn't that great? And then, have we addressed curfew before?
I don't know if we've actually addressed it. Let's do it.
It goes around in fun fact circles a lot, but it's a variation on the old French couvre-feu, meaning cover fire. Medieval houses tended to be very flammable, so it was dangerous to leave your fire burning all night, and to avoid all sorts of problems, they would have someone ring a bell to let you know that it was time to start getting ready for bed and bank your fire. You wouldn't want to put the fire out completely, so you would cover it with a fire bell, a curfew that would literally cover the fire and had like a hole in the top so that the embers could stay warm so you can get up in the morning and make your food and get your fire going again.
So when you talk about a curfew of a specific time, you know, you're essentially saying this is the time you need to shut off your fire and go to bed.
As I recall, there was also a particular region when the French ruling class would also have people go to bed, like the peasantry of the area go to bed at a certain time. So it became more associated with like, you must go to bed now. You have to be inside.
And peasantry as well, we should mention, is a French word.
Oh, right,
peasants.
Right.
Yeah, the ones they used to describe the poor Anglo-Saxons. So it just means country people.
We get our word porcupine from French. It's porc espine, meaning spiny pig or thorny pig.
Oh, there's that pork word again.
Oh yeah, we've got pigs everywhere in English. We also have a lot of words for like random assortments of things in English from French, like hodgepodge had French variations before that. They were all like weird combinations. That word has never been spelled consistently throughout history. But hodgepodge was like an Anglo-French term, a legal term referring to the process of combining things or property owned by a group of people into a common pot so that it could be divided equally among them. But it was also a word for food shaken in a pot.
Altogether. It puts me in mind of potpourri, which no one has anymore, potpourri, because everyone just gets these plug-in things now, but it means rotten pot.
Yes.
Right. And also, I got a text the other day from a friend who was in France, and he had seen in the supermarket the words pique-nique, P-I-Q-U-E-N-I-Q-U-E. And he said, I cannot believe how the French are spelling picnic. Like, we got the word from them.
Yeah.
we're the ones spelling it weirdly. We probably got it from them. It's not certain. It might have come from, because German's got a very confident looking word as well that it might have come from, but French had it before English.
If you're American and you have heard an explanation of the word picnic that is racist, that one is incorrect. That is a false theory. And what Rob said is correct.
Okay. Always pleased to dispel some racism.
Yeah. I mean, the notion is that it came from a racist term, but it did not.
So, I mean, you could just see that the language is, yes, it's got these quite niche words that we've been talking about. And also it's got these everyday words. So it really is peppered with French. And you can understand why people sometimes ask the question, is English still a Germanic language when most of its words are of Latin origin and French has influenced its grammar? Do you have a position on that question, Jess?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear cut that it is still structurally Germanic and that most of our everyday words are Germanic in origin. And just the way we speak has so much in common with other Germanic languages in terms of flow and emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, there is not enough about French in English to really help a French person to learn English, right? They'd get some vocab, but they wouldn't have any other help. Whereas a Germanic language speaker, I think, has a slightly easier time of learning English as a result of the structural stuff, which is the important thing. Because really, what's a good analogy of this? Is there sort of a family tree kind of analogy, a genealogy analogy we can make here, which is that English's roots, right, its ancestry is German. It doesn't matter if it puts on fancy French clothing. That does not change its DNA, the blood coursing through its veins, which is undoubtedly Germanic.
I would argue that the preponderance of Latin-derived French vocabulary in English does make it easier to read French, but not to comprehend it. Because I can read at about a third grade level. I've read Bilbo le Hobbit in French, and it's easy to read because I know enough of the vocabulary to read it. But if a French person starts speaking to me, I will crumble easily.
I feel like I've done a reasonable job of learning it, and I still crumble whenever French people talk to me. They seem to be deliberately trying not to. I was trying to explain this to Jess after our recording the other day. I'll try and do a slightly better job of it. There's another big difference between French and German that I only found out about the other day when I was speaking to someone who, she's an expert in how people learn languages as children. That is that English has a rhythm. It's what's called stress timed, right? So we pace out our sentences based on stressed syllables. And actually that means that a sentence with five syllables can last the same amount of time as, and will last the same amount of time as a three sentence one. So I want ball and I would want the ball take the same amount of time to say, because we just fit in these sort of unstressed words in between.
We know where our stress should be in our syllables.
Yeah, know where our stress. Whereas French isn't like that. It doesn't have, so you can't say with the French words usually, this is where the stress goes necessarily on a word, because actually that's not how it works. It is what's called syllable timed. So English is stress timed and French is syllable timed. And you just sort of meter your way along by the syllable instead. That is the reason why when I want to speak French, I feel I have to get in the zone and put on a sort of French way of speaking and almost a French manner. And now I understand why that is. It's because you really do. You have to change not only the words you're saying, but the rhythm that you're taking on.
My high school French teacher used to like clap while we were speaking so that we wouldn't speak in an English rhythm. You know, if somebody is like, je m'appelle Jessica, you know, like it's that.
I wish my French teacher had taught me that.
It was so helpful. Granted, she was very aggressive with the clapping. It was a lot of it. But like, it also comes up, like you can really hear the difference in words. Like we use the word camaraderie and it is spelled the way the French word is, camaraderie. Every single one of those syllables has the same thing. Whereas we've almost misinterpreted the word camaraderie to sound like it has the Latin C-O-M syllable at the beginning of it. And sometimes you see that as variations in dictionaries now because people assumed it meant like doing something together. But it's more closely related to the word camera because it describes people you spend time in a chamber with. We don't spell the word comrade, C-O-M-R-A-D-E, as we do the word camaraderie or camaraderie, which is spelled like the French word.
Also, one other thing that is relevant to the meter thing we've been talking about, the rhythm of it is that French has changed English poetry. Before French, in old English poetry is all about having amazing amounts of alliteration, you know, just having repeating consonant sounds. Old English poems do not rhyme. I'm going to say that as a big statement. They don't rhyme. Middle English poetry starts to rhyme. Chaucer rhymes, just as an excellent opening few couple of couplets from Chaucer. They rhyme, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And he's blazing a trail there. It's a habit he's picked up from his encounter with French people and from reading French literature.
One interesting thing about the difference in pronunciation between Middle English and Old English is the silencing of the E at the end of words, which Chaucer, like a lot of his words rhyme because you would pronounce the E at the end of a word.
This is actually something that really annoys me about French music. They really cheat by just going at the end of every sentence, to every line to make them rhyme.
You don't say it like that.
That's not fair. You can't just go, la bohème. It'll rhyme with anything if you just go at the end of every sentence. Jess, have you seen the time?
Oh yeah, we've been going for quite some time, haven't we?
We've been recording longer than usual because, well, I've been really enjoying it.
I think it's about time we said au revoir to this episode and to our listeners, because we will return in a few weeks. We do these in 10 episode sets, seasons, series, depending on how you term your entertainment collections. We'll be back in just a few weeks with some more exciting etymology fun for everyone.
We sure will. À la prochaine. Take care.